talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio.
Talk your talk.
Walk your talk.
KGNU talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30 on KGNU.
Welcome to the program. I'm Duncan Campbell, and today I'm really delighted to have once again as my dialogue partner for this special program, my great friend and colleague, Stefan Schwartz. We were last on this program together on March 11, and we also continued that conversation on the following two Sundays. So right off the bat, letting you know that Stefan Schwartz is a Renaissance man, in my view, and our interests and contributions are very similar. He has spent 25 years freely publishing every morning the Schwartz Report. That's S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, Report, all one word. And I highly encourage everybody to go to schwartzreport.net and sign up for that service, which is not costing anything. He's been giving it away. If people want to contribute and can contribute, that's good. But it will come to your email every day of the week with the various trends that he has been spotting from his great reading, just as I have been spotting trends here on this program for 25 years. The purpose of saying all this at the beginning is that you may very well want to either recommend this program to a friend or friends, or go back and listen to it again. So we want to get all the data points out of the way right now. This program is pre-recorded. Our wonderful phone person, Nancy Tatakin, is on vacation, a member of the team. And so also it has to do with the availability of Stefan. So we mentioned, first of all, that our prior program is accessible at kgnu.org/connections for March 11, 2022. And this program will be available at the same kgnu.org/connections for today's date. That's May 13, 2022. Also, our prior conversation was continued in two of my Sunday Living Dialogues programs, and they can be accessed, the ones that Stefan and I did on the future, democracy or autocracy, here and in the world. And that would be kgnu.org/Living Dialogues/March 13, and March 20, two different half-hour programs, March 13 and March 20, respectively, 2022. So, Stefan, we're going to be talking today about your excellent book, The 8 Laws of Change. That will be in part two of this program, and it is subtitled How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. So just right at the beginning, we're going to tell people how to get a hold of that, and then we'll be starting our substance of today's dialogue. So, Stefan, how can people get that excellent book, The 8 Laws of Change?
Well, you can get the book by going to www.stefanaschwartz.com. That's my personal website. You can get it from Amazon. Just search on the title. It's an e-book right now. I am doing a revision because of changes that have happened, and I will be publishing it again in about 2 weeks as a paperback. You can get it from Ingram, or you can get it from Smashword. So any one of those ways can get it. Amazon probably the easiest, and or off my website. And I've expanded it because there have been developments that have happened since it was published that I think ought to be incorporated in how to become an agent of social change that fosters well-being.
Thank you, Stefan. And also, Stefan A. Schwartz is your website, stefanaschwartz.com. And that's where you can find out all the many experiences and background that Stefan has had. We've shared some of them, like being in Russia together, as we talked about. on August 2021 of 1991, when I was on the barricades defending Yeltsin with 2,000 Russian young men. And Stefan was gazing down from the Ukraine Hotel across the street and alerting CNN to this spontaneous, completely unexpected event. He's also done a great deal in citizen diplomacy, and he, like I, has been interested for a lifetime in consciousness, the role of unconscious behavior, and the role of consciousness in how we can actually affect change. And it has to do with a certain kind of awareness and transformation of consciousness, and also fact-based understanding of patterns. So in our first dialogue recently, which was on this program on March 11, I started out by pointing out that America is frequently thought of by Americans as the exceptional nation because it is founded on an idea and not on some ethnic basis, like all other countries, Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, so on. That's partially true. It was revolutionary, literally, in the world of policy and politics in the writing of the Declaration of Independence when it was proclaimed that the essence of government should be a democracy based on the truths that we held, we the founders and we the citizens today, hold as self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator, with certain inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when we say inalienable, that means that a rogue Supreme Court cannot simply take away an existing constitutional right. Certain rights are inalienable, and we will come to that later in the program, such as the individual's right to be in charge of their own reproductive systems and who they want to make love with and whether or not they use contraception, all of these things that have been articulated as a fundamental constitutional right, both via the 14th Amendment and implied in the statement that all men are created equal. So in the meantime, what I would like to do in this program is reiterate that the actuality of the United States of America began with the founders who signed the Declaration of Independence and then financed the entire American Revolution and then wrote the Constitution and signed it. All of these men, were white men, and men of property. This was not a grassroots revolution. It was fired up by Thomas Paine and his famous pamphlet, Common Sense, which was read by about a third of the adult population. Extraordinary. Would be like 100 million people today. And yet Tom Paine was not a man of property. So not only did he not sign the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, he was not able to, and he was not able to vote, because the votes were controlled by the states, and as soon as the Constitution was implemented, they set up the requirement that only white men aged 21 and over of property could vote. So there's this other aspect entirely to our founding of the country, which is often neglected, and it's part of the mystique that is not factually based and not a complete story of our founding fathers. So in a nutshell, we were founded as a white, male, patriarchal, oligarchic, rule by the few, plutocracy, rule by the wealthy. That is essentially what has been very much brought back in these last 40 years since Reagan, and hyper-accentuated and has been added to by a proclamation by the Supreme Court that has just come about in draft form, not only overruling Roe versus Wade, but also actually opening the door to then overrule the right of same-sex marriage, the right of interracial marriage, the right of contraception itself. And so, Stefan, you have written that there are six main trends that are threatening our democracy. I'd like you to go through them. And to that, I would add, and you know you are on board with this as well and have been all these years, that the theocratic tendencies of right-wing politics has now really come to the fore in a very naked way, and that we could say is the seventh trend. But this has been building up in ways that are often not talked about at all. And so, Stefan, why don't you just start on the basis of that wonderful essay you wrote, Can American Democracy Survive? Six Trends That Hold the Answer.
Well, thank you, Duncan. Let's just start off with this. Over 30 million Americans believe in the QAnon theory or conspiracy that the government, the media, and the financial worlds in the U.S. are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. That's quote-unquote from the Washington-based Public Religion Research Institute. I mean, just start with that. How is it possible that in the second decade of the 21st century, that over 30 million people, that's about 10% of the population, believe that nonsense? So here are the six trends. The first one is, I call, the provincial trend. In the richest and most influential nation in the world, 64% of Americans have never been outside of the borders. They have no real conception of what a racist, authoritarian, fascist state would be like or what totalitarianism is to the culture. Americans are extraordinarily provincial. I was really surprised about this. Again, that sounds like a political statement, but it's really just an anthropological fact. A survey conducted in 2019 by One Poll found that 11% of Americans have never left the state in which they were born, and 54% said they have visited fewer than 10 states. So although we think of ourselves as this great sort of internationally sophisticated country, in fact, that just isn't true. The second one is low IQ, low information trend. The average IQ in the United States is 98, and in red states, red value states, it's even lower. So the point here is that when you have people who start off with low IQ, and oh, by the way, I should say that 98 is the average, 34% of us are between 98 and 85, and another 14% are between 85 and 70, which is retarded. And I'm very familiar with that because I had a severely retarded brother. So low IQ, low information, and that also correlates with the Republicans' active activity to dismantle public education. And the reason that they want to do that, Betsy DeVos was, of course, the most famous person under Trump who was trying to do that, to dismantle free public education, is that because they know from a fact-based purpose that statistically more educated people vote Democratic. Because the more education you have, the more you recognize and respect facts. The less education you have, the less IQ you have, the easier it is to manipulate you by playing on your fears, your resentments, and your hatreds. And one of the several things going on in the United States now is that between 2040 and 2045, we're going to become a majority-minority country. That is, whites will no longer be the majority of the population. And that causes an enormous amount of fear and anxiety. That's where all this replacement theory comes from, and where the cultural revolution stuff all comes from. It's all stemming from the fear and resentment that somehow, I don't know why or how they think this is going to happen, whites are going to be replaced. Now, it's complete nonsense, but nonetheless, like the pedophile Satan worshiper thing, it's what people believe. The third one is the social media trend, and this is the one that I think is really scary, and that is Jefferson, for instance, could not see today, and he's originally said the problem was that it was very important that people be able to have access to information. But the reality is that what has happened is the weaponization of disinformation. I mean, we know from TikTok, from Facebook, from Twitter, all these things, there is an enormous and very aggressive disinformation operation going on in the United States. And for people who get their information mostly out of social media, it's very hard to tell truth from fiction. Plus, you have one of the major networks, Fox, which is an active, and it's not a news network, it's an active disinformation propaganda operation. So part of the problem is we have low IQ, low education, and then we have also people who are deluged with misinformation all the time and can't really tell quite what's real. Then the fourth trend that I noted when I was doing this research, and again, I want to really stress this, and I know you agree with me, Duncan, I'm not politically partisan. I care about fostering well-being. My first question about every politician is what they are doing fostering well-being. If it's not fostering well-being, I don't care what party they're in. I mean, Joe Manchin is a Democrat, and he just voted against women's rights just 15 minutes ago. So it's not partisan politics. It's fact-based trends that are really the important part. And the fourth one is the amygdala trend, and that is that the amygdala is a little almond-shaped structure deep within the temporal lobe of the brain. And in every species that has an amygdala, including ourselves, it has always the same function. It's activated during periods of stress, fear, or threat. It's the fight or flight response. And as I said earlier, what's happening is through the weaponization of disinformation, we are stimulating about 27% of the population have overactive red amygdalas. We are stimulating these people's fear and resentments and hatreds by providing them not with factual information, but with active disinformation. The fifth trend is the white supremacy trend. That, again, is being driven by this, we're going to become a majority-minority country, and that's going to happen. That's just a fact. You look at the birth trends, it's very straightforward. It doesn't have anything to do with immigrants, really. It just has to do with how many children people are having. And as the population grows, for the first time in 500 years since the beginning of the Age of Exploration in the 15th century, being born white is not going to automatically confer privilege. And, I mean, you and I understand that and don't see it as a big deal, but for a lot of people, it is a total freak out. And the sixth trend that I think is really worth paying attention to is the America's obsessive gun psychosis. We now have more gun shops than grocery stores. I mean, think about that for a minute. More gun shops than grocery stores. And we have a death rate that is so extraordinary. I mean, in 2020, 39,427 people were killed or injured by guns. It's one of the largest causes of death in the United States, and particularly for children, gun deaths are more a problem than car deaths. So we have these six trends, and then the one that you brought out at the beginning, which is very important, and that is the attempt to bridge the firewall the founders created between church and state. What very few people seem to realize anymore is that the founders felt, one of their strongest feelings was that church and state must have a firewall between them. And the reason that the founders felt that way was that many of them both themselves and their families or their immediate family before, the generation before, had been persecuted by religious persecution because in England, and where many of these people came from, and also Europe, the church and the state were combined. And so they wanted to make absolutely certain that theological issues, theocratic issues, never became involved with politics, because they knew that if they did, there would be great persecution. And in fact, several of the American states, Rhode Island, for instance, Roger Smith was, and Pennsylvania, William Penn, were founded specifically to make sure that church and state were not intermingled. And yet that seventh trend, the intermingling of church and state, and the, I don't even know what to call it, the corruption of Christianity in the United States by Christianity becoming a sort of Christo-fascist white supremacy male dominance cult, which is the core of the MAGA revolution and the Trumpians, is beginning to have dreadful consequences for ordinary Americans, particularly in the red states. And its most immediate issue is, of course, does a woman have the right to control her own body? I mean, you think about that for a minute, and you say, well, of course they would have the right to control their own body. But in fact, we are actively trying to make sure that women do not have the right to control their bodies. If you read the Alito leaked decision citing a 17th century witchcraft persecutor, it's just astonishing. I mean, the mediocrity of it, you would think that a Supreme Court justice would be making incredibly erudite statements about the law. But in fact, the Alito decision, which represents supposedly at least five justices, is really just a political statement about male supremacy and the right to control women. So those trends are going to determine, I think, and we're going to see in November, whether we are going to continue to be a democracy in substance, or just a democracy appearance in form, as you see in authoritarian countries where they have elections, but the elections are rigged. I mean, it's very interesting that the Republicans have made such an enormous deal about all these supposed irregularities about elections, and yet when you actually look at the facts, what you find is that almost all of the irregularities, and they're minuscule, but almost all of the irregularities are done by Republicans.
Yes, in fact, very notably, the Republican that, in a sense, misrepresented his way into becoming the governor of Virginia, when several misleading and false statements he made throughout his campaign, his very son voted twice for his father, illegally. So there's one standard for Republicans and one standard for everybody else. And their standard is actually quite unlawful and unethical in many, many regards. So I want to now move, before we get to part two of this dialogue, for that excellent exposition, Stefan. You know, you and I are completely four square on all of these points. And I wanted to add that leading into part two, which is how can we move beyond this critical stage? You and I both say, and have been warning for years, actually, myself at least since after Citizens United in 2010, that we need to have a democracy 2.0, an actual majoritarian democracy and not a oligarchic, plutocratic control of our democratic institutions, which has now come about as the culmination of a 50-year campaign by the right-wing people in America, beginning all the way back with the John Birch Society, but particularly getting underway with the notorious Lewis Powell Memorandum in 1971, culminating with the Reagan election in 1980 and the so-called neoliberal economy after that, which has done very severe damage to the culture of the United States with enormous and ever-exploding wealth inequality. That's the plutocracy and the oligarchy, but also the sense of the great majority of people not feeling agency. And your trends point out a lot of why that is psychologically and politically. And I want to just introduce the beginnings here for our next part two, that I have been working for the last 25, 30 years on the transformation of consciousness as being a critical evolutionary imperative. If we keep going the way these trends are going, not only will America lose its democracy and move into autocracy, and eventually, on this path, a theocratic totalitarian culture in which open dialogue, respecting truth, and facts-based will be driven underground. And that is the key, as I have found, to the transformation of consciousness, not just tinkering with reform measures on the edges of this great challenge. The great challenge is, can we, as Lincoln said, create the circumstances here for a government of the people, by the people, for the people to endure? And it's come now to the end of the 250-year period that is cited by many historians as the life cycle of a democracy. And so unless we move to a majoritarian democracy, it's entirely possible, as Stefan has said, that we will have the substance gone for democracy and only retain the hollow form of elections that really are already rigged in advance. We look at Belarus, we look at Russia, we look at China, and so on. And so the final comment I'd like to make in this part of the program has to do with co-creative dialogue. I have found that to meet the evolutionary imperative, which includes climate change, the consciousness of our culture needs to transform in a fundamental way. The way Stefan articulates it is to emphasize in all of our actions the collective good and well-being. That will be what we will explore in part two. But the key to all of that is that we have to have co-creative dialogue to shift the consciousness from this extreme polarization and right amygdala-based, fear-based, disinformation-driven culture, which is only getting worse. And to do that, we have to have a stable, small-d democracy. This is the first great challenge in history for a democracy of this size to actually move from a mono-ethnic majority control group to a multi-diverse country, which actually will result by 2040 in the white privileged portion of the population for the first time being in the minority. Sometimes that's called a majority-minority country. And will we be able to actually negotiate that with the kind of oligarchic, patriarchal, white-controlled, plutocratic culture that we have through the arm of the Republican Party? That's a very open question. So with that, I'm going to just remind the audience that you're listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins, up and down the 5 million demographic Front Range, and simulcast internationally worldwide at www.kgnu.org. So welcome now to part two of this dialogue between myself and Stefan Schwartz. In part one, we talked extensively about the many trends that have been building for years in the United States to put ourselves in this never-before-experienced crisis of democracy. I say, and have said for years now, that we're talking not about a civil war crisis. We're really going back to the Revolutionary War. Will the forces that believe in the self-evident truth that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, prevail? with the voting rights being taken away and restricted with the blessings of the Supreme Court in the Brnovich decision, also written by Samuel Alito back in July of 2021, which I've covered extensively on my programs, and also the other trends and experiences that we talked about in part one. So at this point, I think I'd like to begin by saying a deep transformation of consciousness is going to be required, and the people that will be among the primary carriers of this are the millennial generation and the Z generation. The millennial generation is already 50-50 between white and diverse. The Z generation is actually slightly majority diverse and minority white, and that will only grow over time. In my Sunday program, Living Dialogues, on February 13 of this year, 2022, I talked about how the youth vote of 18 to 29-year-olds was determinative in the election of Joe Biden, and that the values of the millennial and the Z generation born in this century, starting in 2000, are actually very much aligned with a majoritarian democracy and very much countered by the prevailing six-headed Putin that we have, a collective Putin in our unelected, unaccountable, unethical, illegitimate, from all of those perspectives, Supreme Court. So we're on a collision course with these people that have lied their way onto the Supreme Court as people now finally realize something I started saying all the way back in 2000 when I predicted that the Republican Supreme Court would overrule the Florida Supreme Court and stop the vote with the 537 margin of victory that the legislature wanted to give to Bush. And they did. And that was really the first and only stolen election in our lifetime, and it resulted in both Roberts and Alito being put on the court. And then the other three that were illegitimate in many ways, each one of them put on the court by Trump, enabled by Mitch McConnell's extensive abuse of any kind of good faith implementation of our institutions and the purpose of the advice and consent of the Senate and so on. So we are where we are now, and a lot of people are feeling a lot of despair, fear, anxiety about what will happen. Many of them have gone into the MAGA camp with their over-determined right amygdala-based, fear-based uncertainty and wanting to have some kind of savior figure in the form of Donald Trump, who said, "Only I can save you." And it's incredible the tens of millions of people that believe that. So to move ahead and save our democracy, I'm going to go right to you, Stefan. Let's talk about the eight laws of change, which are perennial and fact-based, and things that we can do even as we also embrace, especially during the summer, demonstrations in favor of the real meaning of democracy to influence the election and hopefully turn the tide in November.
Well, thank you, Duncan. Let me first say about the eight laws that I did not invent these. What happened was is that with the Citizens United decision on the 21st of January 2010, but really starting even earlier than that, I guess I would say it actually probably started in 73 when I entered government as the special assistant to the chief of naval operations and began to really seriously think about what is shaping the government. I began studying as a result of being appointed to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Secretary of Defense Discussion Group on Innovation, Technology, and the Future. I began studying trends, which I had not done heretofore, not looking at the speculations or the political partisanship, but instead just looking at facts. And what I was interested in and have always been interested in is not what politics you have, but do you foster well-being? Because it seems to me that the key to the future is putting into office individuals that foster well-being and having a system which is predicated on fostering well-being as its first priority. And the reason I say that is because when you look at the social outcome data around the world, you see that those countries who foster well-being, principally the Scandinavian countries, Holland, a few others, that what they have is more effective, more productive, nicer to live under, has much better social outcome data, and is much, much cheaper. And I realized that in that decision on the 21st of January, 2010, the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, that we had legalized bribery. And we now see that in full blossom. If you look at the history and the voting records of members of Congress, you will see a very strong correlation between the people that give them money and the way they vote. It has nothing to do with well-being. You have people like Joe Manchin from West Virginia, a state in which only 28% of the people have been graduated from college, and which has one of the poorest economies. Vote after vote, he votes against the self-interest, against the interests of his constituents, and for his self-interest. Most of his money was made by selling waste coal, the most polluting form of coal there is. So when you look at the American Congress and you see the correlation in both the House and the Senate between how they get their money and who they vote for, you see the full completion of what began with Citizens United, and that is the corruption and the legalization of bribery of the Congress. So the eight laws, how do you deal with that? I mean, if you think about it, most people say, well, you know, I don't have any money, I don't have a government position, I don't have any army, you know, what can I do? I'm just an ordinary guy and or an ordinary woman, and I don't have any power. But the other thing I discovered in doing this research on trends was that, indeed, the most powerful force on earth is the collective intention of a group of people. And that when you look at that and you look at the fostering of well-being, eight laws emerge. And so I'll just go through the laws very quickly. The first law, the individuals individually and the group collectively must share a common intention. That is, everybody's got to be on board with the same idea. The second law, the individuals and the group may have goals, but they may not have cherished outcomes. That is, as Martin Luther King said, he wasn't quite sure how it was going to happen, but he wanted racial equality. So you have a goal, racial equality, but you don't demand that it come out a certain way because you can't predict how that's going to happen. And if you demand that it happen in a certain way, it probably won't happen at all. The third law, the individuals in the group must accept that their goals may not be reached in their lifetimes and be okay with that. I learned this from the abolitionists. If you read the diaries of well-known abolitionists from the 18th and 19th century, what you see over and over again is, I believe that slavery needs to be eliminated. I'm not sure how it's going to happen. I don't even know if it's going to happen in my lifetime, but I'm going to spend my life eliminating slavery. So the fourth law, the individuals in the group must accept that they may not get either credit or acknowledgement for what they have done and be authentically okay with this. One of the biggest problems you find when you look at how groups try to work together to bring change is the ego arguments about I deserve to get credit. And if you look at the abolitionists, if you look at the women who got women's rights and got women the right to vote, what you see over and over again is that nobody knows their name, but they played a critical function in obtaining whatever it was, that goal that they had was what it was, whether it was freedom for slaves, whether it was women being able to vote, whatever. The fifth law, each person in the group, regardless of gender, religion, race, or culture, must enjoy fundamental equality, even as the various roles in the hierarchy of the effort are respected. This is one of the biggest problems that progressives have. They just have a hard time working to see that what they're trying to accomplish, to see that they are all equal, but that there are also people who play more prominent roles. We are high-order primates, and high-order primates, whether they're gorillas or people, all organize on the basis of kind of tribal or group or whatever family hierarchies. So you have to have equality, but you also have to recognize that there are leaders. I think one of the reasons that several of movements have failed was that they couldn't decide and put forward a public spokesman, a Martin Luther or a Gandhi, for instance. The sixth law, the individuals in the group must forswear violence in word, act, or thought. I will tell you candidly, for me, this was the hardest part, because when I was back in the 60s and late 50s and early 60s, campaigning about civil rights, when I saw police sicking dogs on people or beating them with clubs, I would love to tell you that my response was completely pacifist and nonviolent, but it wasn't. It took me a long time to understand why that matters, and it was Gandhi who showed me how to do that, because Gandhi got freedom for his country without a war. It's the only example I can think of like that. I mean, even the founding of the United States required a war, but Gandhi got freedom because of his commitment to nonviolence, and that's what taught Martin Luther King, and he got the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts of 64 and 65 because he was nonviolent. And that is a huge problem. The seventh law, the individuals in the group and the group itself must make their private selves consistent with their public postures. One of the things that stands out as you look at how these organizations operate, or you, for instance, if you take evangelical Christianity, what you find is over and over again, the public persona of an individual has nothing to do with his private self. I mean, you can see this over and over again. I don't want to blame anybody, but if you look at the number of pastors who preach nonviolence, who preach fairness, who preach sexual equality, whatever, and then you find out that they're actually sleeping with their constituents or their congregants or they're racist or whatever. The eighth law, the individuals in the group and the group collectively must always act from the beingness of life-affirming integrity. One of the things that really stands out when you look, for instance, at the present Congress is the lack of integrity. I mean, you look at Mitch McConnell, for instance, in the Supreme Court. He wouldn't even hold a hearing for Merrick Garland, but they pushed through Amy Coney Barrett in an exact contradiction of what he had claimed a year earlier. So the idea that your private self and your public self, you know, Benjamin Franklin when he was sent at the age of 74 over to be the minister plenipotentiary to represent the colonies, or the revolutionary colonies in France, to try to get the French monarch to fund part of it. He wrote, a woman who was a friend of his wrote him and said, "I'm almost sure that your valet is a spy, and he's going to report anything that's going on that you're saying privately to his spy masters." And Franklin wrote back and said, "Inasmuch as I don't say anything in public that I wouldn't say in private, or the other way around, if in all other respects he was a good valet, and he was, I don't care." So you have to be genuinely and authentically who you claim you are. And as you see in public figure after public figure, that just simply isn't true. So those eight laws are the key to creating social change. And the way in which you do this is, I call, the quotidian choice. And this is how individuals, private individuals with no money, no official position, no armies, this is how you do it. Every day you make the commitment that every decision you make about what you buy, what you use, what you say, what you write, will be committed to fostering well-being. Of the choices that are available to you, you always pick the choice that is the one that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being. And you do that. And you tell 10 of your friends that you are doing it as a discipline. And you invite them to join you and ask 10 of their friends. One of the reasons that we do not have inherited royalty or aristocracy in the United States is because of Benjamin Franklin. After this Revolutionary War, the officers of Washington wanted to form together to form the Society of Cincinnati, and they went to him and said, "You know, those of us who were the officers in the Revolutionary War, we really ought to get some kind of title, and we'd pass it on to our children, you know, like a baronet or something like that, a knighthood." And Washington was kind of interested in that, but he thought, "Well, I'll go check with Benjamin Franklin." So he went to see Franklin, and Franklin said to him, "That is complete nonsense." And he sat down and he said, "Look, if you take that individual's officer's children, and they have two children, and those two children have two children, pretty soon you're going to have this huge aristocracy, which already plagues the European countries. Don't do it." And Washington went back to the society and said, "I'm not going to sponsor this." And that's why we don't have hereditary titles in the United States. And it was done because you make, of all the choices available to you, you always choose the one that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being. And if you do that and you tell 10 people, and they do it, and they tell 10 people, you just lay out the numbers, and pretty soon you can see exactly how the November election can be won.
I think that really hits the nail on the head, Stefan. And as we are coming toward the conclusion of this particular program, I want to go back again and emphasize the interrelationship of your work and my work, in the sense that I have been for the last 25 years saying that there is an evolutionary imperative, and that evolutionary imperative has to do with getting out of all of the polarity or self-importance or ego-based consciousness that is continually at this point being exacerbated by our media, social media, and the lack of a kind of inner adherence to truth and an external adherence to truth. It has become clear to me for these last 30 years that the evolution of humanity is also at stake. It's not just our democracy. It is really whether or not the species is going to survive. And
yes,
that has to
absolutely.
Do.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Boy, that is so important.
Yeah.
The only way we're going to get through climate change is by recognizing all life is interconnected and interdependent, and that we, even as a species, are not going to survive if we don't realize that.
And that's been my point again for 30 years, that we need to, as a species, meet the evolutionary challenge of the cosmos itself, which is infinitely expanding. It's all interconnected, and it keeps manifesting higher and higher levels of diversity and unifying that diversity at higher and higher levels of coherence and harmony. And that is actually what we need to replicate in our society. I've already talked about the challenge of diversity here to a democracy, that when the dominant white patriarchal ethnic group that founded this country is now, as Stefan has said, for the first time in 500 years, having its white privilege challenged by a beautifully diverse population of many, many different kind of ethnicities coming together around the principle that all men are created equal, endowed with certain inalienable rights, including the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is actually the idea of America. And so the reality now is more and more the potential of all of these diverse ethnicities to come together and create a rich and very vital fabric of society that could be a beacon, in fact, to people around the world, how to make this shift in consciousness, which will also imply the interrelationship and interdependency with all of life, all the species, whether they be plant species, animal species, that we are in a celebration of life. And that's going to require this transformation, what I call co-creative dialogue. No more Moses on the mountain, if you will, where one person becomes the bearer of truth and then comes down from the mountain and tells everybody else what to do. We see a very perverse example of that in Vladimir Putin. We see a very perverse example of that in Donald Trump and all of the minions that are running for office now who admittedly have come right out and said, well, I said one thing about Trump a couple of years ago, but things are different now. Now I think he's terrific, and he's giving me his endorsement, like someone like J.D. Vance, for instance. And so what we need to do here is have the space for co-creative dialogue. And as we move into this kind of theocratic plutocracy, that space is going to be more and more eliminated institutionally. And when we have, for instance, Twitter taken over by a billionaire who paid seven times more to have that privatized and under his personal control than it would have taken to eliminate world hunger. You see, we've come to just an extraordinary crisis in our situation as human beings, and that is what we are being called to right now. I will say going forward that I have embarked on a series of dialogues on my Sunday program, Living Dialogues, beginning with October 24. You can go to kgnu.org/Living Dialogues. And every Sunday from October 24, 2021 through the present, I've been talking about how this co-creative dialogic transformation of consciousness into a wise and compassionate culture can happen. In one form, I talk about it as a post-COVID renaissance, in the same way that we had the Black Plague that eventually did a reset that resulted in the Renaissance. So with that, we're coming to the very end of our program here. And Stefan, I just want to say that our example of co-creative dialogue that you and I have engaged in personally for many, many years, and also in the programs we've done together, has been just a sheer delight. That's the other aspect of it. When you commit to truth and when you commit to well-being, you resonate with the Dalai Lama's statement that the road to happiness is through service to others, service to the collective and its well-being. So for all your work, all these years, Stefan, I just want to give you a great kudos and appreciation personally and on behalf of the collective.
Well, I would say the same to you, Duncan. This is very important. We really are at a crossroads. And I hope that everybody that hears this program or any of your programs adopt this business of the quotidian choice, because if we can get enough people to change their way of conceiving of where not only they but collectively where humanity is in the on the earth, that we are part of the matrix of consciousness, and we individually each support that and foster its well-being, we have a way through. And if we don't, I'm afraid it's going to be an awful lot of suffering and death. So I really applaud what you're doing as well.
Thank you so much, Stefan. And again, I want to underscore what a delight it is when we do these co-creative dialogues and inspired by and evoked by the deep listening audience that we have here at KGNU for so many years. It is the deep listening audience which evokes these kinds of conversations, is participating directly in what is being said by evoking it. And we want to go out with a real tribute and gratitude to our deep listening audience and look forward to being with you again in 2 weeks here on May 27. And I invite you in the meantime to listen to my next two Sunday Living Dialogues programs, May 15 and May 22. 12:30 to 1 p.m. here on KGNU, when Richard Tarnas, author of Cosmos and Psyche, and I will be in co-creative dialogue as how we could create a dialogic, evolutionary, wise, and compassionate culture to meet our planet and species' evolutionary challenge.
Day after day, I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know that's the game I hate to lose. I'm feeling the strain, ain't it a shame? Gonna give it a beat for the free my soul. Don't get lost in your rock and roll. I'm wasting time. I don't understand the things I do. The world outside looks so unkind. Now I'm counting on you to carry me through. Oh, I'm giving up before the free my soul. Don't get lost in your rock and roll. That you've given me. I want you to know I believe in your song. Rhythm and rhyme and harmony helping me along, keeping me strong. Oh, I'm giving a beat for to free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll. Oh, I'm giving a beat for to free my soul. I wanna get lost in the rock and roll and drift away.
lost in the rock and roll and drift away.